Welcome to Credit Exchange, your weekly podcast where we speak to the biggest newsmakers and news shapers in finance. I'm your host, Lisa Lee. This week, my guest is David Satowicz, head of U.S. liquid credit at ICG, a global alternative asset manager with $127 billion in AUM. Welcome, David.
Hi, Lisa. Nice to see you again.
Great seeing you, David. David, I keep saying this every week, and I'm going to say it again. The pace of geopolitical news is breathtaking. We had the U.S. President, Donald Trump, threaten the annihilation of the Iranian civilization earlier this week. Then a reprieve was announced for a two-week ceasefire between the U.S. and Iran. The Iranian foreign minister said it would reopen the Strait of Hormuz, the all-important conduit for global oil supplies, for that time period. U.S. equity markets have cheered, with the Dow surging more than 1,200 points on Wednesday as we tape, and oil prices have fallen below $100 a barrel. For a year, 2026, marred by geopolitical headlines and turmoil, this week has still been astonishing. David, this is a financial podcast, not a geopolitical one. How do you even think through a backdrop like this?
Yeah, well, again, thank you for having me on. And yeah, I'm not a geopolitical expert, so part of this is, you know, a little bit out of my comfort zone, but it is, you know, the world that we need to be investing in. And so to ignore it is just not possible. You know, to say we live in interesting times, I think, you know, is to say the least. You know, coming in a day after this ultimatum is quite, you know, an astonishing thing. And, you know, I think probably the most impactful part of this to me is how little the markets seem to react.
Yes, really did not react much at all.
No, and you know, when we think about what was being said and what was being contemplated, you know, oil even at it, you know, was a, you know, almost like 120 a barrel felt low.
Mm.
And you know, I think then there was this almost inevitable pause, and it happened to be a Tuesday, and everyone, you know, likes to call those Taco Tuesday trades, if you will. And so it kind of, I was at dinner with some other people in the industry, and it kind of came out at that time, it looks like, hey, we're going to have a pause. And right then you kind of knew that kind of the what it felt like at the time was that the first part of this conflict was maybe over. And that's what the market, I think, is kind of telling us. So, look, I certainly have no idea how any of this plays out. Again, not an expert in this area, but what I will say is, you know, the market is discounting a lot of the bluster that we're hearing. And it seems that there have been enough of these situations over the past couple of years where, you know, I think we're starting to get numb to it. And so the real question is, you know, is this kind of the new normal where we have these sorts of bouts of volatility based on, you know, potentially very negative outcomes, knowing that that outcome won't come? Or do we eventually get to a place where it's like the boy who cried wolf and we get desensitized, but one of these times, you know, a worse outcome occurs? And I think, you know, the market does not believe it's the latter. And I think today's, you know, relief rally is a good example of, you know, equities coming back strong. You know, the loan market came back to exactly where it was. Everything feels like, you know, we don't believe that that latter is outcomes of possibility.
But to your point, are we being desensitized? Should we be desensitized? Because there was a real war and ships did not move out of Strait of Hormuz for 5 weeks. That's going to change the shape of the oil markets, isn't it? We've had infrastructure damaged.
Yeah, look, I think that the longer term implication, regardless of whether a truly bad outcome happens here, is infrastructure has been damaged. Oil prices do feel like they will have to remain somewhat elevated for a period of time. That I think as a base case does not seem to be an unreasonable outcome. beyond that, it's kind of who knows. And we can talk about, you know, what the implications are for spreads and topics like that. But this environment has a lot of unknowns, more than I've encountered in most of my career.
Right. I would agree with you. There's just, the world seems very uncertain, and equity prices and credit spreads don't seem to in any way reflect the uncertainty and even the possibility, even if he walks back this moment, that the world's not the same and that there's might be 3 more years of this.
Yeah. And I think that in and of itself is something that, you know, the market has internalized. I think, you know, the market believes that they understand how this administration operates, and it's going to react this way until there's a reason not to.
Okay. And do you think in any estimation, do you think might be that reason not to? Because I thought a war with Iran might be that catalyst, but clearly not.
Yeah, you know, we haven't been able to find the geopolitical thorn that actually does seem to derail these markets. And I think there's a lot going on. We're at an interesting time where there's a massive technological innovation that may be overshadowing things that might have been taken much more seriously before. I also think in the U.S. specifically, while oil prices are bad for everyone, this particular issue might be more negative for Europe and Asia, and that may be part of the reason why we haven't seen a greater impact at home. You know, one place where you might see it is, you know, longer term bonds, you know, are starting to decouple from shorter term,
mm-hmm.
you know, and maybe over time that's just speaking to confidence in the overall kind of longevity of the system. But, it's not obvious.
So hopefully the ceasefire holds. And that and there's a resolution and the Strait of Hormuz opens up. But as two ages we just spoke a little while ago, infrastructure has been damaged, oil prices are going to stay higher, and that has changed the macroeconomic outlook. It is not the same as it was 5 weeks ago. We are now expecting inflation again and higher, for example, with higher prices at the pump. And importantly, global central banks, I have stopped their rate cuts. So probably higher for longer. We were in a period where we were expecting the Federal Reserve and others for interest rate cuts, and that does no longer is on the table. So what is your expectations for the economy going forward?
Yeah, so I think you brought up a good point. We were, I think, consensus-driven 2 rate cuts over the next year felt like what most people were expecting. And then very recently, particularly as oil has shot up, we've thought, hey, maybe there's a rate rise coming. And, I mean, literally in the last 24 hours, you know, I think the odds have moved slightly back to a rate cut again.
Well, oh, it is.
Yeah, I think it's right on the border. Mm-hmm. So, but I think the point is, higher for longer is reasonable. We're not seeing massive cuts from here, you know, in at least not in the near future, if we have our crystal ball out. So, you know, that has implications, you know, on a lot of things. What I focus on mainly is overall GDP growth, and I'm not an economist, but, you know, Goldman still has us growing, you know, on a GDP basis, you know, first quarter we ended, you know, 3% real GDP growth, and they have somewhere, I think it's 2-2.5% through the rest of the year. Again, multiple things are happening. We have the big, beautiful bill that's
coming up, yeah.
Lowering taxes. You know, we're having, you know, a lot more what we may want to call an industrial renaissance as we're building semis at home. We're, mm-hmm. you know, increasing pharma spending at home, defense spending. Yeah, and then, of course, AI spending, all that data center and energy spending. So I think that there is a movement of very strong long-term forces that are pushing the economy along. Where it gets uneven, I think, is the inflation side that you pointed out. Look, ultimately, prices for driving have gotten more expensive, and airline prices have gone up with jet fuel. So I think it's the consumer that's getting hurt. And when you kind of drill down that a little bit, I would argue that the low-income consumer is getting hurt even more because it's fairly regressive in that sense, right? So I do think that we are going to see consumer pain, and particularly on the lower-income side of things.
And that's already even going into this economy, even going into this conflict. We had a K-shaped economy with what some people call the elongated K. Constantly, every single move seemed to hurt the lower end consumer. And this is just exacerbating it. What are the consequences? Not the societal one, but the economic one. We could discuss the societal ones later. Economic consequences of constantly having a consumer, lower end consumers in pain.
Well, I think, it is abnormal for the U.S. GDP split to be what it is. I think normally consumer spending is about 2/3 and investment, is a lot lower. I think at the end of the last year, investment spending was 40% of GDP, which is high for our economy. And that doesn't feel like it's sustainable forever. Mm. So one, I don't know if the whole economy can continue on without consumer spending. But, it does feel like we could have certain sectors get hurt while others do really well. And that does seem to be a trend that we're seeing. So I think anything consumer related, whether it's housing, whether it is, anything that's got to do with travel, apparel, retail, those areas, I think, are all feeling a decent amount of pain. And I think they will continue to. So we could have a strange situation where we have strong growth, but, weak consumer. And we haven't even, accounted for the fact that student loans are going to start being turned back on. And that's another expense folks are going to have to pay for. So, it does feel like the one can't be positive without the other. So maybe I think over time, even with all this growth, unless we can somehow spread it out more broadly, we will see some weakness hit the market overall.
And we really haven't had any real job creation. That's what the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said. We've had good job figures, we've had bad revisions, but net-net, we don't seem to be creating new jobs. How does that psychology impact the consumer and also your forecast for the economy? And I said, I understand you're not a macroeconomist, but you are an investor, and every investor I know has some view of the economy. So I'm just trying to get yours.
Yeah, look, I think jobs are at the heart of the economy. And I think if you look at most economists' estimates, the jobs are going to be, about flat. We might see a little bit of weakness there, but ultimately, that doesn't seem to be a short-term problem. Mm. I think, what people are worried about is AI taking jobs, and long-term impacts like that. But so far, we haven't seen it. And I think the other thing we've heard is, younger people not having jobs, entry-level jobs, not being as plentiful. But at least from why that's happening, it's not AI-driven, and could it be ultimately economic, global economically driven? Potentially. But what it means is the places where jobs are have to do well, and we have to make sure that we're able to transfer people over to those places. And the sectors where we won't see that strength, are going to hurt, and we already are seeing that. And I think you mentioned with a K-shaped economy.
Okay, and is the same sort of sectors that you think will be impacted by this?
Yeah, look, I think that, particularly the consumer, we're worried about housing. As rates stay higher for longer, housing, which has not been in a great place for some time now, will only continue to struggle. The building products, anything related to moving, all that economic halo around housing is continuing to be weak. And so I do think that, that has real implications for people everywhere. So I do think anything consumer driven, anything housing driven are going to be particularly impacted.
So far we've talked about the negative, but I want to move into something you already talked about and something that's been pushed off the headlines because of this, the Iran war, has been artificial intelligence, the amount of money, the CapEx spend, and the new technology, just mind-boggling, right? The new applications that are coming through, and also the announcements for what the data center builds. So tell me about AI, because I know this is a sector that you have to think about, that is impacting software, but it's also you have data spending loans and financing. There's so much going on. Help us parse it out, David.
So AI is incredible, and I think that there's a lot of positives that you can point to, you know, more broadly. I think in our little neck of the woods, AI is probably more of a headache than anything, okay, at least in the short term. Mm-hmm. And I think you touched on the impact on software, and that's, you know, how we're trying to process it is, you know, what are the implications short term and longer term? And, you know, I don't believe most people can say where a lot of these software companies are going to be 5, mm-hmm, 10 years from now. You know, short-term earnings have generally been pretty okay. But I do think that where we're going to start seeing problems is the 2028 maturity wall.
Okay.
And so a lot of software was done in 2021. And a lot of those are low-rated credits. You know, I think 50% of the 2028 maturity wall are B3s, and a lot of those are software. And so the specter of another Claude, you know, software announcement makes the refinancing of those loans the tricky part, because I don't think we're going to see performance weaken in these loans very quickly. These companies, it takes time for technology to, I think, impact companies. So, but still, you do need to say, am I willing to go out another 3 years in an extension? And am I willing to go out another 7 years in an extension? So, you know, over the next, you know, 6 to 12 months, if you consider, you know, 28 maturity, you know, will be a very telling time as to, you know, how does the market believe these companies will do over time? And the onus is on the companies and the sponsors to, you know, tell that story in a way that's credible to the market.
So tell me, what if I come to you and say, hey, David, I'm a sponsor. I own a software company. What should I do? What should I be doing? Because to your point, most companies are still doing well. So this is not about the current. It's about the future. How do I future-proof myself against AI, and how do I tell my lenders and to the market that I've done this? What would your advice be to these companies, to these CEOs, or to the private equity firm, if you have any advice, if there's anything they can do?
Yeah, look, I think there are some things they can do. I think one is come out and have the conversation. I think companies that have had conference calls, sponsors that have put out notes, I think do generally help people think through what are the bets that they are making, and what does this company do and its implications, you know, in this newer world. So I think one, help people understand. I think two, what we've seen on conference calls and a lot of people being fairly effective at is saying how they're using AI. And you kind of realize it's not necessarily a competitor, it's a tool, and how they are ultimately beneficiaries. So explain to the world exactly, you know, this is how we are going to benefit from AI. So I think one, just being out front, telling the story. Two, you know, explaining, you know, the relationship of these companies with AI. And then look, three, I think results have to follow. So business models that are successful, companies that are successful, you know, valuable companies tend to do well. And I think quarter over quarter, we're going to have to see them follow through with putting up good numbers. And so I think it's the combination of those three things.
So you're still invested in AI software companies, and the market has seen some new software financing that have done really well, some that haven't. So how do you distinguish between the ones you want to be invested in and the ones you don't want to be in right now at this moment, where bankers still are bringing software loans to market and where there's secondary trading of software loans? How do you pick and choose? Your thoughts and your methodology.
Yeah.
So, or do you say no to it all, right? No software at all on my portfolio. That's one a different choice.
So we don't say no to software. We are still participating in software loans. And, you know, what we do is we have frameworks to how we think about things. Like one, you know, we have something called an AI impact score where we look at, you know, is this company 1 to 5, 1, a huge beneficiary of AI, or 5, you know, potentially negative impact from AI. And so we score it, and then we're able to one, bucket the risk and figure out, is this something that we would want to, you know, be involved in? And if it's a new opportunity, if you're a 4 or 5, the bar becomes very, very high, obviously. So that's one way is separating companies that we think have true disintermediation risk from others. And then two, you know, we look at business models. So one of the things we're seeing with some of the software companies out there is the way that they are building up their revenue models. So historically, it might have been on a seats basis. And if you believe that seats are going to go away as a result of AI, you may flip to a firm license. And we've seen that happen in real time. So the way that they're packaging their product is important and understanding.
Already they're changing. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, in real time. And I think, you know, everyone in these companies is reading the same headlines we are and is living it much closer up. So they, you know, as good management teams are adjusting as well as they can. And so we want to see those sorts of answers. And there are a lot of companies that will benefit greatly from AI. And again, I think a company's ability to articulate their strategy and the way that they will utilize this powerful technology is going to make us want to be involved. And so the kind of the onus is on them to explain that to us in a way that I think, you know, the market will be able to understand.
To your point, there's a maturity wall. I mean, there are loans and there are debt that need to be refinanced because they just can't pay it down through the natural amortization. Are we looking at a lot of restructurings then? Are we looking at some LMEs? Are we looking at bankruptcies? How bad will things get? Because this is a big swath of the market.
I think yes to all the above. I think we will see some LMEs. We will see some bankruptcies. And, you know, I think that when that does happen, at least if you look at the recent history, recoveries will be probably worse than we've seen in some time. You know, the last few years, if you look at historically, you know, we were probably getting 60 cents on the dollar for first lien recoveries. Now we're getting sub 40 if we do get to that actual restructuring event. I do think that that's part of this vintage of companies generally and software being a large aspect of that will have their share of pain. If you remember, a lot of these were done in 2021 where multiples were high.
Really
high. Very, very high. And base rates were very, very low.
Wow.
You know, this was going to be a problem regardless of AI.
Interesting because the finance funds, they love the software, recurring revenues, no way to lose. So I was like, really? When you're putting that much debt, can we put as much debt as possible? Let's put 8 times, 10 times. And you're saying, no, that was never a good call.
It was never going to work out for everyone. I think there's plenty of companies that will do just fine. And I don't think that there's going to be widespread default. I think we're going to have massive spikes. But I do think that there will be companies that were built for, you know, built with a certain capital structure that are no longer, you know, in the right capital structure for today. So if it was a 20 times business before, it's now a 10 times business. It was 8 times leverage on 20 times is different than 8 times leverage on 10 times. And at the same time, you know, they put in a lot of equity in a lot of these deals, a lot of times 50% of the capital structure's equity and sometimes more than that. They need to recoup their investment. And so that makes the want of some sort of LME much higher.
Right.
So I do think as a result of that dynamic, we'll definitely see some activity that allows for LMEs to happen. The documents allow for it. So it's a question of sponsor will and you know the need to get you know a recovery on their investment.
But on the flip side, we're talking about AI disrupting software. But we also have AI borrowing heavily. They're tapping every single market, it seems, in the apparent universe. So are you a fan? Are you looking at these AI loans and financings and being like, okay, there's so much coming down the pike. How do you pick and choose?
So most of it's been done in the private market, and very little of it's been done in the broadly syndicated market.
And high yield, I thought we had some, no?
High yield, there have been some, but by and large, it's been done outside of our market. So some of it's investment grade.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really get to participate in the hyperscaler debt in that it's too low yield for what we do. As they start kind of trickling into the loan market, which is really kind of, you know, 90% of what we do, you know, we'll look at them. I think that, you know, I lived through the telecom build out in the late 90s and early 2000s, and that didn't work out so well. So
yes,
when we think about infrastructure build outs, we're going to be cautious. I think that, you know, at this point, they seem like they're fairly attractive opportunities. And I think that they will continue to be for a period of time. But inevitably, we're going to overbuild, I believe. It's impossible not to know when we've built just enough. And at that point, we'll hopefully it won't be a massive overbuild and the market will be okay. So we will participate when we see deals come to market. At some point, we'll have to, you know, take stock of where we are in that cycle. But I don't think we're anywhere close to a meaningful negative event anytime soon.
So given everything, given what oil is, given what the economy is, just astonishing. But to your point, it's supply and demand, and there hasn't been that much supply. Now, you talk to a lot of financial sponsors and PE guys. And one of the things last time, what happened at Liberation Day, we had market turmoil. Everyone came back except for LBOs, really. It seems like they went pencil down and no one lifted them back up. We were starting to hear rumblings again. So when you talk to sponsors, are they saying, okay, this is taco, it's just noise, we're keeping on going with our acquisition talks? Or do you think they'll, once again, there might be a bit of a pause, and it'll take a while before we see LBOs come down the pike?
So I think it's somewhat industry dependent. I think these processes take a long time to develop.
Right?
And so there's no deals being stopped because of what's going on. I'd say the last 2 weeks were maybe, you know, fairly unusual. And so there might have been a slight pause in the last couple of weeks. But let's say this pause that we've seen, you know, in terms of hostilities from last night is enduring, then I don't think you're going to see much of a meaningful pause from this specifically. You know, industries like software, yes, you're starting to see a little bit slower refis and new deals there. But beyond that, I think that the deals are continuing to go ahead. And while we haven't seen the volumes that I think we would like, you know, I don't think that, you know, we're way behind on M&A. We're down year over year, but you know, I don't think it'll slow down much more in the coming weeks. Eventually, you do have to see some volume.
Mm-hmm. And then let's talk. Move to what you just brought up: private credit. They've been in serious competition with the public markets for the last 3 or 4 years, but now this year, once again, AI and Iran has pushed it out of the headlines, but private credit has gotten some negative press. And also, especially in the U.S., they are even more heavily skewed towards software industry, and they've started having huge withdrawals from their non-traded BDCs, those funds that cater towards the affluent and that offer to provide 5% liquidity per quarter. Given all that's going on in private credit, are they still in competition or are they sort of sidelined for the moment? What are you seeing?
I think they are still very much in competition. I think that there is a lot of dry powder still left in private credit. I also think that closed-end funds and funds that aren't structured like the interval funds that you're referring to,
yes,
you know, this is a potential opportunity for them. So I don't believe that there that one, all private credit's painted the same. There's a lot of different types of styles and strategies and quality of managers. And I think that, you know, just sometimes exposure to different industries can be a differentiator. But I think more than anything, there's been a lot of allocation to this sector, and I don't believe that's going to stop. In fact, you know, we were speaking to an institutional investor that invests in private credit, you know, last week, and they have seen spreads kind of get a little wider in private credit. So they're actually thinking about, you know, deploying into this market. So
Institutional investors are still keen.
I think sophisticated institutional investors that know what the bets are that they're making, I think are picking their spots. Yes.
And what you're also telling me that the private credit guys, even for all the headlines and some of the funds, like to your point, not all of the funds, some of the funds having withdrawals still have their mojos. They're still going after the big deals and saying like, we're our doors are open for business and we're doing it. But let's go through specific sectors. Do you still see them in software? Because that's been the big criticism, that they went way too hard on software, especially their firms in the US are like 40%, 60% geared towards software. I mean, that is contrary to all sense of portfolio management, right? Such industry specifications. Are you still seeing them in all sectors, or have you noticed a behavioral shift?
So we haven't seen a lot of new software deals out there, given everything going on. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say that folks are still diving into those. I think the bets that have been made, you know, we'll have to see how those turn out. And I'm sure that you know, the folks that have made those bets are going to be very focused on them. What I will say for private credit, and again, like I focus on liquids, you know, the one thing that a lot of those deals have is a seat at the table. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to get in a distressed situation, that's an incredibly important thing to have. So they do have an opportunity to work things out. And so I think we may be seeing the demise of private credit a little too soon. Mm-hmm. I think we need to see, one, how these companies actually perform, and two, when you have a seat at the table, how you're able to actually help the outcome get better. So it's a little too early to say, you know, where private credit ends. I think from a liquid perspective, what I really think about when it comes to private credit is, you know, the impact on the liquid market. So yes, we've seen much more loan only structures. We've seen much more unitron structures. We've seen leverage in the syndicated market increase. I think conversely, we've seen, you know, private credit deal spreads come in. We've seen documentation weaken in the private credit market. So they're starting to look very similar to syndicate deals. And I think that convergence is really probably the bigger story, at least right now. Ultimately, recoveries on various investments may become a bigger story, but I think it's too early to kind of go there.
You've been great, and I really appreciate you being on.
Thank you, Lisa. I appreciate you allowing me to come chat with you. It's always a pleasure.
It's such a delight. Thank you. And to our audience, thank you for joining me. Join us next week for another edition of Credit Exchange. And do follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This has been Lisa Lee. Goodbye.